Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics Show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and today I'm very pleased to have as my guest, for the first time in her new role as Congresswoman of the 2nd District in Iowa, Marionette Miller Meeks. Congresswoman Meeks previously served as a state senator in the Iowa legislature and won her race for Congress in 2020 by 6 votes. Don't let anybody tell you one vote doesn't count. She was previously a guest on this show twice, once during her primary election in 2020 and once during the general election. And now she's here in an official capacity. Congresswoman, belated congratulations, and thank you very much for taking the time to be on.
Thank you so much for having me, Robin. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
Your background, and we'll get into that as we proceed here, is very, very unique, I would say, and interesting, and it relates to a lot of the issues we're going to be talking about. And first of all, as we're taping this show later on Thursday, the news, tragic news out of Afghanistan today, the terrorist bombing. What's your thoughts on this and how the nation proceeds moving forward on what's going on there and our efforts to get troops out? What are your thoughts right now?
Well, as you know, Robin, I'm a 24-year military veteran. I'm a Vietnam-era veteran, although I did not serve in Vietnam. My brother did serve in Vietnam. 6 of my family members, my husband is also in the military, enlisted also during the Vietnam War, and was deployed after 9/11. I think what happened today is devastating, it's tragic, and it's a travesty. Several members, military veterans, bipartisan, have since April pushed the administration, Secretary Blinken, Secretary of Defense General Austin, General Milley, and Secretary of Homeland Security Mayorkas. We have been pushing for them to expedite removing American citizens and also our Afghan partners and interpreters from Afghanistan. It is, I think, apparent that this is a complete operational failure of execution. And once again, our military has been put in this position where they should not have. Our military has performed in an exemplary fashion. They have been stellar in their conduct and in their treatment of the Afghan people. And this failure of our president to make the case for why maintaining a presence of 2,500 troops in Afghanistan was imperative to keeping the homeland safe, I think is an additional failure. So it is a travesty what has happened today. It was fully predictable. General Milley said so, in the briefings we've had with him, that it was very fluid, it was very dangerous. We knew it was to be dangerous, and I think, operationally, you don't advertise your actions to your enemy. The Taliban had already shown that they could not be trusted. We had a reason to be in Afghanistan with the small number of troops that we had there. We were not in combat. We were not at war. Our reason to be there was to conduct counterterrorism, to conduct intelligence, to have Bagram Air Base as a launching pad for activities within the Middle East, and then also to prevent other terrorist organizations from, again, once again, using Afghanistan as a base of operations. So not only did we fail in our mission for counterterrorism to help keep our homeland safe and secure, I predicted last week that we would be in another war in Afghanistan because of this failure. So we have failed our military. We have failed to honor their service and their sacrifice. We have failed to remember the lessons we should have learned when we pulled out of Iraq and ISIS became predominant. And we have failed to learn from what happened in Vietnam. This is the second war in my lifetime that we have won militarily and we have lost politically. So it's a travesty. It is heartbreaking to me. I cannot tell you how I am doing everything I can to help both our military that are still there, our American citizens, whether they're within the consulate or contractors, not just in Kabul, but throughout Afghanistan. as well as our Afghan interpreters and partners who we should have expedited their removal and not waited until the entire country, other than a small portion, was taken over by the Taliban.
Based on your experience and knowledge, and what do we need to do to extricate ourselves from this mess moving forward? To you know, what steps do we need to take? And is this August 31st deadline, should that be still observed, or do we?
No, you know, the deadline should not be observed. We should use what air power and military air power that we have. We should retake Bagram Air Base. We should extricate all of our individuals, all American citizens, and our partners who are surely to be executed, which will, again, their execution will be again used in order to propagate further terrorism and prevent us from intelligence gathering, which we need in the Middle East. So we have a mission to help those individuals. And if that means that we use our air power and we have strikes there, protect civilians to the best of our ability to do so. But we have a duty and a moral obligation to extricate Americans, to extricate our Afghan partners, and to make sure that they get out of there.
You're a member of the Homeland Security Committee, which is, I'd say, an excellent choice with your background. But are there concerns now? The original reason we went into Afghanistan was to eliminate that country as a terrorist breeding ground. Are there concerns now that we can be right back to where we were with our withdrawal?
I think that's an excellent observation, and absolutely. We're very concerned that what has happened. Remember, prior to 2 weeks ago, with only 2,500 troops and an air base in our control, Bagram Air Base, the Taliban was in the periphery and the rural areas. So we were able to conduct counterterrorism. We were able to do intelligence gathering. We were able to use air power should we need it in a military fashion in order to protect our American citizens as well as our military there. And within a very short period of time, the Taliban was able to take over and march into Kabul. And so absolutely we are concerned that once again this failed state will become a terrorist breeding ground. We already know that there is Al-Qaeda, the relationship between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda is very strong, and we have now seen the rise of ISIS-K, so it is very concerning, in addition to which individuals coming across our southern border, because we don't have border security at the present time, as our Border Patrol agents are occupied with trying to process individuals coming over illegally. As you know, this year, 1 million, we're at 1 million people coming across our border illegally. So in addition to people on the terror watch list, of which we were informed when we were at the border, and the drug, we also now have to be concerned that there may be more individuals coming into our country. You know, this show of weakness by our president and by this administration helps to further the concerns that we have that Afghanistan as a failed state will become a terrorist breeding ground.
What's your reaction? When I talk to people about Afghanistan, people say, geez, what happened? And we were there 20 years and the Afghan military just basically melted during this latest offensive when the Taliban moved towards Kabul in 1 week. Was that a failure of our military training? Was that a failure of the Afghans or a failure of our political leaders?
That was a failure of our political leaders. So I want to let people know that over 67,000 Afghans have died in defense of their country. There has been one U.S. military casualty or death in March 2020 until today. We were at this juncture, we were not at war. We were able to have a relatively stable environment in Afghanistan where we could conduct counterterrorism. That was in my mind, our ongoing mission and why we were there. If you're considering having military troops in a location or in a country, then the longest war would not be Afghanistan. You would have to look at South Korea, which we have over 20,000 troops stationed in South Korea. I was stationed in South Korea. My husband was stationed in South Korea. We still have troops in South Korea, but no one considers that, you know, the longest war or a 70-year war. Nonetheless, we had a mission. We had a reason to be there. It's up to the president. And I don't care what party the president is. This is not a partisan issue for me. It is up to the president to explain, you know, what the mission is, why we're there, so that people understand what we're trying to achieve and how we're trying to keep the homeland safe. But we now have more American lives and more of our military that have been sacrificed for an arbitrary and political timeline. So the timeline needs to be extended. We need to use whatever measures that we need to do in order to preserve, save American lives. And our partners who will surely be beheaded.
Congresswoman, as much as we like to think the world, everybody acts in their interests, in the interests of global peace and all, we've got some, it's a dangerous time out there. And I keep reading where the signals this may send to not only our allies, but some of our adversaries. In your position as well as a veteran and a member of the Homeland Security Committee, I mean, is that a concern? Are there going to be stepped up measures here to kind of be on guard for what could happen next?
I think that I had given a speech on the House floor on Monday evening when we were called back, and I said the actions of this president will make our homeland less safe. Afghanistan seems so far away and so remote, and people think, well, you know, it's no big deal to get to an airport. You know, we can go to an airport and Moline, or, you know, for me, from Ottumwa to Des Moines, it's, you know, an hour and 45 minutes. But Afghanistan is a country the size of Texas. So for people to be out in remote areas where they were gathering intelligence, working with the tribes, to get into Kabul, to get to an airport, it could be an all-day trip. It could be 10 hours. The roads were impassable. We warned the administration in June. I mentioned this to Secretary Mayorkas when he was testifying at a hearing that, you know, the Taliban had cut off the roads. And we know that when we have a show of weakness, that other bad actors come forth. So when the United States chooses not to use its strength and its wisdom in order to be a benevolent superpower, if you will, other bad actors fill that vacuum. And we totally anticipated that because of the actions of the president towards Afghanistan and pulling out the troops to me, there was no plan. And in the military, there's a saying that we have that is, if you fail the plan, you plan to fail. We had asked for information, we had asked for clarification, we did not receive that. So we know that other bad actors, we know that China has increased its aggression in the South China Seas and towards Taiwan. We know that Iran was already emboldened by President Biden going back into the Iran nuclear agreement, and we know that Russia will also be more aggressive. So I think the world is a much less safe now than it was, much less safe place now than it was just a month ago.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is the newly elected congresswoman serving our area, Congresswoman Marionette Miller Meeks. She serves on the Homeland Security, Veterans Affairs, and Education and Labor Committees. We've been talking about the issue that's had everybody's attention this week, and leading up to today, and the terrorist bombing in Afghanistan. Her very passionate views on this issue, which, again, with her experience, plays into a leading voice on this issue. I want to turn our attention a little bit to some domestic issues, especially one area you've been very involved with. I'll ask about that in a minute. But with the budget bill and the infrastructure bill coming before Congress, the budget bill, the framework, I guess, is what they call it, was passed this week. What's your overall thoughts on this bill? And I don't want to take the COVID issue lightly in that it may inflame again and hurt areas of our economy. But is there a concern that maybe this is a bit much and might have some other economic hardship or bad consequences?
Yeah, I think you're right to frame this as a framework. I didn't mean to use framework twice or frame twice, but most people think that we were actually voting on the $3.5 trillion budget reconciliation bill and the $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill. But this what we voted on, and they brought the two of them together to get them passed because the moderate Democrats were holding things up. So if people always liken legislation to sausage making, you think of this as what we what was passed on Tuesday was the casing for the sauce, and so then it goes to each different committee to put their part of the sausage into the casing. And so that's what was passed, was this framework or building block or casing for the budget. And at $3.5 trillion, absolutely too expensive. We have already had massive spending in the very short time that President Biden has been president, in addition to which Senator Sinema has come out and said that she would not vote for the $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill. So it may not even pass in the Senate. And then you wonder, why are we spending time on this when we had very serious issues already with Afghanistan? It is another bill that is not fully paid for. And I realize spending in Washington, D.C. is both a Democrat and a Republican issue, although it's more on the side of Democrats, the tax and spend Democrats. We have already seen inflation skyrocket. Grocery store prices are up, bacon is up, milk is up, gasoline is up, especially after canceling the Keystone Pipeline and stopping leasing on federal lands for oil and gas production. So, and then, as we know, our president went and begged OPEC to produce more gasoline after having stopped our own domestic production where we were energy independent, which is also another thing that makes us less safe. But I think we need to be responsible. We need to be good stewards of the economy. We need to continue to get our economy open and working, which benefits all of us to do so. I think additional spending will continue to fuel inflation. And I just think it's problematic. We're also raising taxes. And one of the things that, we did not expand spending on was defense and Homeland Security, especially towards immigration and Customs and Border Patrol.
The infrastructure bill had some bipartisan support in the Senate, and it's going to be, before the House. And you've been one, I know, in the campaign, you talked about looking for opportunities to work with the other side of the aisle. Is this a bill in its current form that you can support?
Well, I think we did talk a lot about infrastructure, and I'm very supportive of the $110 billion in the infrastructure bill that is for roads and bridges. $4.2 billion of that would be for paving, building, and upgrading roads in Iowa. $431 million would be for bridge repairs in Iowa's airports. There's $66 billion in railway, which predominantly goes to Amtrak, which gets most of that funding. Water infrastructure, and as you know, we're working very diligently in our state on water quality issues and expanding broadband. Those are things that I talked about on the campaign trail, continue to talk about, but we also know that this bill is not paid for. It could be paid for out of unused COVID monies. Even before President Biden passed the $1.9 trillion additional COVID money, there was almost $1 trillion that was unspent, and so this could be paid for, but it is not paid for, and so it's another one of those issues where we're concerned about the level of spending and then what all is tied to it. If infrastructure bill is tied to the reconciliation bill, which we think is what's going to happen, it is not something that I can support, even if there are individual pieces of the infrastructure bill of which I'm very supportive.
You've been named to the Veterans Affairs Committee. Again, a good match with your background and skills. I know you've been very active in these issues, and you've actually had some substantive legislation passed. I want to allow you plenty of time here to talk about that.
Well, I will say I'm very honored to be on Veterans Committee. We have a great ranking member as well as chair of that committee. I have now passed seven bills, two of which have been signed by President Biden. The majority of these bills are, in fact, bills that are related to veterans, whether it's veterans' access to mental health care, job and job creation. So our vet tech bill, which has a very short course, 6-month training program, for skill sets in computer data management, technical skills, for them to have jobs in the very short time the program was open. Over 2,000 veterans had gotten access to the program, to that educational level, and had been employed at jobs making over $57,000 a year. It is a great program that we expanded funding to. Several of the bills, as I said, were mental health, suicide prevention, transitioning out of the military and getting the assistance going from active duty to back to civilian life. And this is especially important when you've been deployed and you come back not to a military base where you have other support services, but you go back to your local community. Making sure that veterans in rural areas have access to mental health services. And there are rural mental health services called RANGE programs. And one of the bills was to fund three more centers, which we hope one of which will be located in Iowa, although we have no guarantee that that would occur. So it's been a real honor to serve on veterans and to serve the veterans that of which I'm a member. And I think it's a great committee to be on, a very bipartisan committee, because we're truly trying to work and do the best we can for veterans. We're working through things like toxic exposures, be they from burn pits, because we don't want to wait another 20 or 30 years to get veterans access to care and disability benefits, like the waiting time that happened with Agent Orange. So these are issues that we're working on throughout veterans, but veterans care, veterans mental health, suicide prevention, access to workforce. We've talking recently about licensing issues, which is something we've done in the state of Iowa as well. Very proud to serve on that committee. It's very humbling, and it's a real honor.
Another topic is the election reform bill that the Democrats are trying to pass. It'll be coming up soon, I believe, based on what I've seen. You've got a great perspective on that too, having won a very, very close race, 6 votes. There was controversy over your seating, and finally you were seated. What's your view on election reform at the federal level? Is this bill in its current form something that's good, or is there anything else you could support in a slimmed down version?
So the we passed election law changes in our state the past several years, and because of those election law changes, it made our election process in Iowa a more secure process, where people would know that their vote counted. They could, find out if their vote counted and was counted. That we secured ballots, should they be ballots that were sent in by mail. And we, our Supreme Court, as you know, upheld our voter ID law. What has happened at the federal level is not, it is a misnomer. It is not a voting rights bill. Those states that enacted election law reform actually have more early voting and more access to voting by mail than many of the other states. And for instance, then President Biden's own home state of Delaware. And so this is a federal H.R. 4, which passed in the House on Tuesday night. H.R. 4 is a federal takeover of elections. I do not think it's going to come close to passing in the Senate. We know constitutionally states are authorized to conduct elections, and not every state is the same. Not every locale is the same. We have laws that work very well within Iowa, and furthermore, we have had record voter turnout in 2016, 2018, and 2020. So how anybody can say that people are not having access to vote, or we have not made it easier to vote, I would say is disingenuous at best. There has been record voter turnout, record voter registration. We can certainly continue to do more. And I read an interesting article. I'll have to find you the reference source, but I read it, I think it was maybe 6 weeks or so ago, that was talking about that minority groups actually vote more under voter ID on those states that enacted voter ID, and one of the reasons is because campaigns reach out to them. They make a more concerted effort to reach out to these voters, which is what we should want, that candidates make the effort to reach out to voters in all areas and all ethnicities, regardless of what party, because when you're elected to serve everyone.
I have time just for one more question, and it's only about 1 minute, but I just wanted to ask you, being a congresswoman, I mean, that's a great honor, and I know you well enough through our interviews that you consider it that. Has there been anything that surprised you or pleasant surprise or your major impression since you took the oath?
Well, it's certainly, a challenge to be sworn into office during a pandemic. But, one of the most refreshing things I had was to find out that within Congress, you have this opportunity. They're called 1 minute and 5 minutes. And so there are times when you can address the House and it gets entered in the congressional record. It has been one of my most humbling experiences and a tremendous reward and joy to be able to talk about Iowans. Most people don't know that we had four Iowans in the 2nd District in the Olympics or Paralympics. To highlight someone who has done humanitarian efforts, has given to their community. It could be, a local high school that has won a championship, or, for instance, Luca Garza when he broke the point record at the University of Iowa basketball, or when we won the wrestling championship. But to be able to highlight your district and your state, I think, is tremendously joyful. And, Robin, before you go, I just want to say this, that I want every military veteran to know that the work that they have done has had a purpose, that they're loved. We thank them for the sacrifices that they've made, that if there are individuals who have served in Afghanistan or Iraq and they need to reach out, please feel free to contact me. I've had many veterans do that already. If they have a friend or a loved one who served and they need to reach out, to please contact us or to reach out to other individuals. This is extraordinarily, extraordinarily difficult for our veterans. And then to let them know, the Veterans Crisis Hotline is free. It is confidential 24/7. And the number to call is 1-800-273-8255, or they can text to 838-255. And if you could disseminate that information, I'd be very grateful.
We'll keep that right on at the end of the interview here. And thank you for sharing that, Congresswoman. And thank you very much for taking the time during a very, very busy and somber time today to be our guest. I appreciate that. And I know our listeners do as well. Congresswoman Marionette Miller-Meeks from the Iowa 2nd District has been our guest today on Heartland Politics. Congresswoman, thank you again.
Thank you so much, Robin, and please have everyone keep our military and our American citizens and allies in Afghanistan in their prayers.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.